Joined in studio now by Elaine Loughlin, who's political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and by Gary Murphy, who is Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government in DCU, to go through the Sunday papers. Thank you both for coming in this morning. We will talk in a few minutes about Colm Henry and the reaction to COVID, but I suppose we'll start with one issue which is quite prevalent in today's Sunday papers, and there's a lot written across all three of the broadsheets, particularly in the Sunday Independent, around government communication, particularly in the aftermath of the whole question of, Elaine, are we going to be required to keep a log of whatever one eats in a pub, and why does the government care whether I had the goujons or the chicken wings? And it does, you do get the impression that the government really would like to be talking about, you know, public health measures and what you can do to keep the country safe, and they just can't help but getting themselves down into rabbit holes around whether you had the goujons or the chicken wings.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem is at the very start of this pandemic, everyone was terrified, so therefore they were on board with anything the government came out with. Mm. Now, as Colm Henry stated just a few minutes ago, people are fatigued. They want to get back to some semblance of normality. We know that it's going to be at least 12 months before we have a decent vaccine in place, before perhaps you can think about getting back to what the old world was and living your life normally, maybe shaking hands again or hugging. I don't know whether that'll ever happen. But then this kind of miscommunication. One day we come out and we hear one rule possibly coming into force. Another day there's a U-turn or a rollback or a change of mind. And people are kind of trying to find their way in this new life. And then the government aren't really telling us how to do it not in a clear manner anyway.
And it's part of the difficulty with that then, Gary, when you go back a few weeks to the new tightened restrictions and you're told that you can meet in gatherings of a certain size indoors, but the same ones aren't necessarily allowed outdoors, and you can have a gathering at mass, but you can't have a mass gathering, and you can have people in a pub watching a match, but you can't have people on the sideline watching a match. And it kind of does go back to the perceived inconsistencies of those as well.
Yeah, and it then goes against the grain of we're all in it together, as Colm Henry again elucidated just a few minutes ago. Roisin Shorthall was writing about that again today in the Business Post. And it made me laugh to hear both Micheál Martin and Stephen Donnelly saying that, there's nothing new in these. Well, there actually is quite a lot new in them, it seemed to me. And
these are in the regulations this week about the keeping the log of all the meals.
Yeah, exactly. Because
what's new in them?
Well, I think what's new in them is this idea that a guard can go in and basically check the restaurant equivalent of a logbook, as far as I can tell. And I think that is new, and that was give this impression of, you know, the Gardaí potentially, you know, dominating how restaurateurs run their businesses.
But aside from the fact that they are now open to being checked by the guards, the government will tell you that they're not being required to keep any record that they didn't already have, because you have to keep a copy of your till receipts
for
months or years for tax
anyway.
Exactly, yeah. So basically, Stephen Donnelly is saying that that's all you need for this. All we need is a record of what you served at this table, and that's fine. But so then why all the communications fuss over?
Well, I think that's what you'd have to ask Stephen Donnelly and Micheál Martin, because the way this was interpreted by the sort of both the commentariat, but also by restaurateurs themselves, if that's the right word, was that this was overbearing state. And it brings back to the point you just raised of sort of one rule for one group of people and another for another group of people. And I do think my DCU colleague Ona Malley is writing about this today in the Sunday Independent, is you can see the frustration of rural publicans who are not being given the chance, as they see, to open their business and run good, solid family-run businesses in many of these instances. And, you know, a lot of these are in rural Ireland where there has been very little or even no case of COVID for months. And I think that's the difficulty. So, you know, I did have a wry smile when I listened to Stephen Donnelly on the News at One, talking about that he was bemused by the overreaction. I think, to put it mildly, he's had a bit of a torrid time. And could you imagine Fianna Fáil were in opposition?
Yeah.
And this was announced by a Fine Gael government, there'd be uproar.
Well, part of this then, Elaine, I wonder, is whether the opposition is doing Ireland much of a service, because if it turns out that all these regulations do require you to do is keep the receipts that you already did, and I suppose the proof will only really be in the pudding when the guards go in and whether they're happy or unhappy with someone doing it. But if it turns out that all you have to do is keep the receipts, but you have opposition parties decrying it as bonkers and crackers and almost adding fuel to a fire where no such fire ought to exist, is that maybe part of the problem is that the opposition are telling us that there, in fact, there might be a problem when really there isn't?
Well, I think, again, it comes down to clear communication or lack of communication. We did have a day and a half where we thought that pubs and restaurants would have to itemise the exact meal that every single person had at the table. So you'd have to have an account of Mary goes in, you'd need her phone number and the fact that she had a goujon on chips and a pint on the side, and whoever was with Mary, you'd have to have the same details. That's not the case. And I know Micheál Martin was clear on Friday. He was slightly confused, claiming that it was an overreaction. It was only an overreaction because people weren't clear about the guidelines and didn't know that it was a simple receipt with the total and a receipt just purely to be used as proof. Another thing, though, around this is Stephen Donnelly also said on Friday that it's nothing really to worry about because these guidelines won't be in place for long. When all pubs, the wet pubs, and I hate that term, are reopened, that these guidelines will no longer be in force. So we have a scenario potentially where you could have pubs and restaurants who are currently open, currently serving food and drink, having to retain receipts for 28 days, which will be far longer than the actual legislation is in place.
Because the regulation is supposed to lapse in 10 or 11 days, but they're still going to have to keep the receipts for longer than that.
Like, it also, it seems to me, begs the question of why the regulations were written in the first place. If the government was worried about, as it seems to have been in relation to something like people at GA games and like the 200 people, I thought the regulations as they were in relation to the €9 at a meal, and I've been out to a few restaurants, was working pretty well. But I mean, clearly the worries and the spike in numbers has affected.
But when Helen McEntee was in the Dáil this week trying to introduce the newer laws to allow for the clampdown or closure of pubs, she said that in the space of about 2.5 months when they were doing these inspections, there were a total of 165 outlets that were breaking the rules. But like, none, I don't think any of them were being accused of breaking the rules two or three times. So it seemed like a bit of a drastic overreach.
It seemed like the classic sort of overreaction and the sort of, you know, sledgehammer to bash a nut, you know, old cliche. And the other thing about your issue about the opposition, but you know, remember also Mark McSharry, who was like, you know, in Fianna Fáil, was one of the first people out to complain. Now he is of course, a serial complainer of issues within government and within the Fianna Fáil party itself. So maybe he's not the best template to use, but
I'm
you know,
sure
he is a part of.
Justified,
but he is a part of.
But
the,
maybe describing it as being Stasi-like was perhaps a little bit beyond the pale. Of course, this going back to the whole question mark about pubs as well, and some suggestions that pubs could be provided for with a quick opening, the so-called wet pubs. If anyone, by the way, does know where that phrase came in, 53106, because I actually can't find out where that phrase originated from. This idea of having a wet pub, does that mean that they only serve moist food? Anyway, there's talk about how wet pubs could be allowed to open again within a couple of weeks, although I see Alan O'Keefe and Hugh O'Connell today in the Sunday Independent saying that some of those publicans are very sceptical about the idea of being given a date in the middle of this month because they've missed several dates already. It's kind of jarring that there seems to be so much clamour, understandably from the publicans, but also from some levels of the public, Elaine, to reopen pubs, knowing that the way in which people do socialise in pubs and how Ireland likes to congregate in pubs, while at the same time COVID-19 cases are genuinely going up.
And this is a point that Sarah McInerney makes today in her piece. She's saying that pubs should be the least of our worries, should be the least of government worries. And I think it was quite telling, Colm Henry, alluding to the number of ICU beds that we currently have. So we've currently 370. He also said that 500 is the international best practice. So we're 130 below what we really should have at a time that we're facing potentially a second wave of COVID.
And what I didn't get into with as well was in the peak of the first wave, we still weren't anywhere close to 500. If we'd taken all those closed operating theatres and turned them into ICU beds, we still weren't anywhere close to having 500 at the time.
And there's also reports today that we won't be taking on all those beds in private hospitals that we did during the first wave, that it'll be possibly just taking on private hospitals or using private hospitals for things like ultrasounds, x-rays, the kind of day-to-day stuff that hospitals might not be able to cope with when we are
I mean, it,
to do.
It still seems to me it's not terribly clear why we alone in Europe don't have our pubs open, pubs who don't serve food. And I don't think any of the public health officials have really answered that question. I mean, there is, of course, there's a caution, and then my own mother, who's like 80 this year, was cocooning for months. And of course, there is a caution that a second wave would, you know, be calamitous for society at large. But I think, and this is, I think, what the Taoiseach did. The Taoiseach, of course, he's the Taoiseach. The Tánaiste, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach in his own mind, I think was alluding to when
that is the most Freudian of all the slips we've ever had.
Was talking about when he said that perhaps we're doing things too cautiously and too slowly.
Well, what I admired about that, firstly, was Leo Varadkar is the Minister for Enterprise. I get that there's collective decision making, but the Minister responsible for business and enterprise, you know, standing up and bemoaning that businesses and enterprise weren't being allowed to open. But not only that, also the dissonance of, you know, while a Fine Gael Minister for Justice was downstairs in the Dáil Auditorium in the Convention Centre trying to introduce new laws, you know, which enable the quicker closure of pubs, he's upstairs demanding the quicker reopening of pubs.
And they're close. The Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, and Leo Varadkar, they're very close by all accounts. So, I mean, it is part of his sort of demeanour to be straight talking. But, you know, we're in a unique government in one way with the historic alliance of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And you would have thought in the middle of still this pandemic that the government would be speaking at one. I mean, it seems to me a government without great unity of purpose, it's still feeling its way. Shane Coleman has an interesting piece to say that it will survive long term in today's independent. But, you know, I think the jury is still out on that.
Do you think that, do you share Shane Coleman's optimism, Elaine, that the government now, apparently unified by Phil Hogan, that they might last the full term after all?
Well, talking about public communications, there's a severe lack of communications within government, where Fianna Fáil ministers don't like telling Fine Gael or Fine Gael ministers what's going on in their department and vice versa. So the workings of government are a mess at the moment, a shambles in some case. And just to go back to the reopening of pubs, I know the publicans are probably trying to be as measured and, you know, they're trying to get their heads around this. But I'm just baffled by how or why rural small pubs are not making more of a fuss at this stage. You know, they've been closed for 6 months at this stage. And especially when you look at the likes of Sligo, where we've only had 157 cases in the past 30 days. Leitrim, or in total, I beg your pardon, there's only been a handful in the last 30 days. Leitrim has only had 87 cases in total.
Yeah.
How do you put them
in the same pot
as Kildare, that has had, you know, over 2,000 cases? So is there an argument for reopening certain parts of the country at a faster pace than others, just like we shut down three counties at one stage?
Would
as
that
well?
Work, Gary, or would you then have the possibility that if you had pubs open in some corners of the country that you'd have people, you know, well, maybe they shouldn't be driving, but people attempting to travel hundreds of miles and then, you know, sort of damaging the good work that those counties have done by bringing the virus with them?
That, I think that is the danger, certainly. And, you know, we're talking here as well about not just the imbibing of alcohol, but about, you know, social interaction. People go to the pub to interact with their peers. And you could see the temptation certainly would be, you know, to drive across a border and even have, you know, a shandy or a Coke or whatever. So I would have concerns there. But
you put a capacity on each pub. That's very simple. If people know that only 10 people are going to get into X pub and Ballydehob,
yeah, like
wherever.
Capacity in restaurants. Like,
yes, you won't have a busload turning up to a pub where they know they won't get in.
Well, Micheál Martin did point out, I think, in one of the papers on Friday, that you know, the pub night out, as we know and loved, is not coming back anytime soon, and I think that's actually a sort of global phenomenon. Really.
What I thought actually was remarkable, Elaine, you and I were both at that media up with Micheál Martin on Friday, where he made that, and I think you put the question to him, is this another communication screw up by Stephen Donnelly? And his response was, oh, this went through many departments. So he wasn't denying that it was a bit of a screw up, but he said it was an all of government screw up, which I suppose is a hallmark of where we've been for the last few months.
Yes, but Stephen Donnelly in particular, we've seen numerous flyers come from him and U-turns at this stage. You know, he kind of came out with Gardaí would be allowed to enter homes at, you know, to get or
to break
deal
the house
with
party.
The house party issue. That was absolutely knocked back at cabinet. He also had another flyer that people could be fined on the spot for not having a face mask. We haven't seen much of that since.
No sign of the red list that he promised about a month ago.
Exactly.
Or the idea of.
No sign of any sort of change to the green list either. Now, that does seem to be moving, and we probably will have an update on that on September 14th.
Still, we have the winter to come.
Still the winter to come. We're going to be at this for an awful long time, aren't we? Stay with us. We're going to be talking about the great scramble to replace Phil Hogan and tomorrow's Leaving Cert points issues.
It's a wake-up call for the EU side. We've got to a position where there's only 2 points, really, that are holding us back. But the reality is the EU's best moment to strike a deal with us, with all the pressure that they are trying to amount, is now.
Dominic Raab, the UK's foreign secretary there, who's been on Sky News and the BBC this morning. We'll hear a little bit more of what he's had to say as we look ahead. He says, as if that's something that you do with optimism. Look ahead to another week of Brexit talks. We'll be doing that a little bit later here on News Talks on the Record. In the meantime, we're still going through the Sunday papers with Elaine Loughlin from the Irish Examiner and Gary Murphy of DCU. There's a fair amount written across the various pages, Gary, about how exactly we came to fill the vacancy of Big Phil Hogan, which was obviously created at 10 days ago or so. You'd get the impression that between the Sunday Times line that Ursula von der Leyen was basically trying to headhunt Mairead McGuinness, and then Simon Cove and his pals telling the Sunday Independent that he didn't want it if he wasn't going to get trade, that really the cards were marked from the get-go. So why did it take so long?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's only a question they can only answer in government. There's also a very hard-hitting column piece by Jerk Holleran in the Mail, where he has a right go at the European Commission and Ursula von der Leyen, and says the government should have told her where to go and just nominated the person they wanted. And he points to the fact that we had a treaty defeated. Lisbon.
Twice, yeah.
Yeah, well, Nice first and then Lisbon. In relation to Ireland losing Commissioner was the central part of Lisbon, I remember, I seem to recall.
So the big concern was that we were moving from a union of 15 to 25 or 27 or 28 member states, so they wanted to try and whittle down the Commission
which
again.
Which would be too unwieldy. So then, and it was the idea that, you know, we're all Europeans, so, you know, the Bulgarians can look after the Irish or vice versa. Was a very big issue because Micheál Martin, I think, was Minister of Foreign Affairs, who then commissioned a report on why people voted no, as they did, and that was certainly a part of it. So Jerk Holleran,
the same Micheál Martin who then was aghast when the people of the West wanted a minister from the West, and he was telling them that they could like it or lump it.
Well, the geography wasn't as important.
What I think is kind of striking though about that idea, and I know they didn't in the end, and they said that they never really did entertain it, but they clearly were entertaining the idea of only sending a one name.
Would have been Simon Covey.
But with the commission being as big as it was, and if you're no guarantee of getting a big gig, if the one specific instruction that you get from Ursula von der Leyen is send a woman and a man, and you dismiss it, there's a fair chance you're going to be given one of the commissionerships that nobody really wants to exist, which only exists because of the Lisbon Treaty concession we were given. You end up having Simon Covey sent over and made like the commissioner for multilingualism or something.
Why wasn't it Michael O'Kennedy was the minister or the commissioner for personnel, which was basically...
They still have one of them.
That's the low of the low. And reading his interesting interview with Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Independent, you know, I'd say he looks like he did want to go. And then once trade was off the table, so to speak, he decided he'd better stay. And again, there's more mixed messages. I mean, I was quite astonished in one way that he was willing to go, you know, because we just alluded to it earlier on, Brexit is still a huge issue for the state and the running of the state in relation to COVID and health coming. You would have thought that we would have needed a person who has good and long experience and is well-meaning, I think, being in government as distinct from going off to Brussels. And, you know, the government in one way again has only itself to blame here. In relation to the Phil Hogan saga, you're certainly, you know, he can only, yes, he has to take responsibility himself. But it was all, again, these mixed messages from the beginning. And ultimately, when they called for his resignation, what do they expect?
Elaine, what do you make of the dithering from Simon Coveney about whether to take the job or not?
Yeah, well, Jerk Holleran may have wanted us to give the two fingers to Europe, but I think Justine McCarthy in the Times today said, well, actually, Fine Gael especially tried to give the two fingers, but then in the end had to go along with the demands of Ms van der Leyen, because she actually intervened through the EPP, the party that she and Fine Gael are associated with in Europe. That's how seriously she took this. And as well, I think it was telling in the middle of the week when she said that she wanted a woman and a man as opposed to a man and a woman. That she really did want that female put forward. But I know from covering the piece, our own paper covering the piece on Monday, we were almost certain that Simon Coveney's name was going to be signed off on Monday evening. And I think Simon Coveney was fairly certain himself and was gearing up to make a public statement on that.
So what changed?
Well, the three leaders we know were meeting and were in constant dialogue throughout the week is the line that was being trotted out anyway to journalists. Something changed, that it was decided that perhaps we might be better off going with the two names. Perhaps they were getting indications. I know there was a lot of back channels between Dublin and Brussels around what sort of portfolio we might get. They were still pretty confident at the start of the week that trade was within our grasp, which I found slightly confusing, given that we did very well to start off with as a very small country to get that portfolio, and how we were going to retain it in the midst of this scandal was sort of confusing. So then it obviously became clear that we wouldn't get that portfolio, that we would be downgraded, and it looks like we're going to get one of the finance portfolios at the moment, maybe budget and administration or financial services, depending who gets bumped up into that trade portfolio.
Yeah. I think they just misread runes in relation to what, if Simon Coveney was the only nominee, as to what portfolio he would get. And I can only imagine that the signals then coming from Ursula von der Leyen and the Commission is that, sorry pal, you're going to be down the list. And then that becomes a question for the government. Do you want, you know, a heavy hitter to be sort of wallowing in Brussels, you know, doing very little, or at the centre of what is a government that is still in crisis and has crises to come, including, as we said, you know, Brexit, health, and the ongoing pandemic.
Well, another crisis that could be on the government's plate as early as tomorrow, and certainly when the CAO points are out on Friday, might be a crisis around the Leaving Cert. And at least, Elaine, we did see this week some of that being headed off at the pass with school profiling being dropped. But nonetheless, we still don't really know to what effect points are going to be inflated by tomorrow's grades. We still don't know exactly how many people are going to be done out of grades that their teacher genuinely thought they got. Even if it's only 0.1% of grades going down by two levels or more, that's still going to be, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of individual subjects all getting marked down. And it's just, it's all a bit open-ended, and that really, that could be another very big issue for the government this week.
Yes, and in a regular year, without this COVID drama to deal with, we've always see very emotional scenes outside schools where people are very upset, people are very happy, and you can imagine that's just going to be multiplied tomorrow when people get their students get their results. The problem is that on any given year, a student may, on a very good day, get, let's say, a H1, a top mark, and be a top student, but for whatever reason, they're running late, they had something personal going on in the background.
Yeah.
They might drop
their dog
down.
Died or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. They drop down a couple, or just the paper didn't suit them, and they drop down a few marks on the day. But then they can go back and they can see that paper they did, and it can be corrected and it can be looked at again, and it can, you know, potentially can go up mark, potentially not. The problem with this is, a person's teacher will have marked them on their very best day. So all of those students, thousands who went in or should have gone in to sit exams over the summer, will be marked on their very best day. And in any given year, no student, not all students are going to be on their very best day. And secondly as well, there isn't the papers there to look back on. If a student has a problem with the result they get tomorrow, there is no evidence there for someone to go back and look and see, well, actually, you know, question five, you got marked 20, you should have got marked 25, and now that'll bring you up in your grades.
You can't just go and look back over it. The best possible explanation that I heard for the failing in projected grades, Gary, was the idea that, you know, a certain amount of kids get dumped or lose their grandparent or lose their dog every year. Yeah. And now, because of the algorithm has tried to standardise that, you have people having their dogs virtually killed and dragging down the results when, in fact, they did nothing to deserve it. But as a man of third level, it must worry you a little bit that some of the students who are going to be enrolling in your courses and anywhere else in DCU or any other institution next month, that they're going to have a fairly crap college experience, really, aren't they?
Oh, it's terrible. It's desperately worrying.
I don't know if you're being sincere with that.
No, I am. I'm being very sincere because I have a daughter who was in DCU, and I have a son who's going into Leaving Cert who might go to university next year, the year after. But it's terrible. And our scenario in DCU is we're going to teach, I mean, first years are on campus 3 weeks out of the 12, I mean, weeks 1, 4 and 7, let's say, for 3 days of those 3 weeks. And then in those 3 days, you get taught 3 hours a week. That's it, yeah. So it's like, it's very little teaching face to face. Most of our
And a lot of them are still being expected then to try and find accommodation in Dublin to attend college for virtually 0 hours.
Yeah, we have a scenario, again, and I think other UL is the same, where we are, for some of our on-campus accommodation, it's a bit like Airbnb that you can book in for, you know, week three and week seven and whatever. And I think that has worked so far as I know. But the experience is going to be extremely different. Most lecturers big classes will be online, and then we're going to have some tutorials. But again, I'm not sure, you know, do I wear a face mask? Do my students wear a face mask? I assume we do. Mm. So it's going to be very different. On calculated grades, the issue, of course, is 17% doesn't sound like a lot, but 17% is a lot of
it's
students
one in six,
tomorrow
yeah.
who are going to be very
unhappy. And most people do six or seven subjects, so the likely is they're going to drop grade on one of them for no fault
at all. And you think like junior cert is an accurate predictor for the most part, but not always. And then you have the issues about, as Elaine so eloquently put it, in relation to students having good days and bad days. So it's there's a great piece by James McDermott in the Business Post alluding to Charlie Chaplin and Waterford Whispers. But again, he points out that this is a serious business.
I only wish you had more time to sound out Waterford Whispers and Charlie Chaplin, but I'm afraid we're completely out of time. Thank you both very much for coming in this morning. That's Gary Murphy, who's a professor of at the School of Law and Politics in DCU, and Elaine Loughlin, who is political correspondent with the Irish Examiner.